O Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we're going to be looking at the beginning of the second canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Of course, this is where Shukadeva Goswami begins his discussion with Pariksit Maharaj. Second canto is a mystery to a lot of devotees. It's a difficult canto. Sometimes we don't have a very clear idea what it's talking about. But we're going to try to, with the help of Prabhupada's presentation, and we'll look at the original commentaries, especially by Srila Sridhar Swami, Jiva Goswami, and Srila Vishnu Chakravarti. And we'll try to get an overview, at least of the first three chapters, of what's going on in this second canto. Of course, it's said that the Bhagavatam is like the embodiment of Krishna. Krishna svadam opagate dharma gyane dibisaha kalau nastra jishamesha puranarko dinoditaha. The sages at Naimisharanya, some years after Krishna's disappearance, were concerned. Now that Krishna has left this world, and religion, and knowledge have also disappeared from the face of the earth, what will be there to maintain the principles of religion? And Suta Goswami's answer is that this Purana, Srimad Bhagavatam, has risen like the sun, and it is direct incarnation of Krishna in sound. And there's a description elsewhere how the 12 cantos of the Bhagavatam are like the different limbs of Krishna's personal transcendental form. Especially the first two cantos are his lotus feet. And it's also stated that, beginning devotees should not even go beyond these first two cantos until they've become more or less free from gross material, desire for sense gratification. So it's very important for devotees to study the first two cantos. Bhagavatam, of course, is a very unique work. It's the essence of all the Vedic literature. Bhagavatam, although it's eternal literature, we'll discuss that a little later, how the Bhagavatam is actually eternal scripture. It's not that someone wrote it at some time. But also, at the same time, the Bhagavatam is especially meant for Kali Yuga. The cycles of history is repeated. There's a Kali Yuga every single Divya Yuga. Every 4 million years is another Kali Yuga. 4 million? Yes. So Bhagavatam, although it's eternal, it's especially relevant for Kali Yuga. And therefore it emphasizes a very direct, simple process for becoming Krishna conscious. That's Nam Sankirtan. If we can turn one of the fans up a little higher. Yeah. Maybe just that middle one. Very last statement in the Bhagavatam. Last verse of the last chapter of the 12th canto. Nama Sankirtanam Yasya Sarva Papa Pranashanam Pranamo Dukashamanas Tam Namami Harim Param. So the very last statement of the Bhagavatam says that I offer my respects to that Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, Krishna. The Sarva Papa, the chanting, the Nam Sankirtan. It doesn't just mean doing japa. It doesn't just mean chanting some japa, some mantra, or just meditating, but Nam Sankirtan, which means in pure love, ecstatic love, chanting Krishna's names, this destroys all sins. Sarva Papa Pranashanam, Pranamo Dukha Shamanas. And we're so entangled in our material life and suffering in so many ways, but simply bowing down to that same Krishna, just bowing down to him, just surrendering to him and taking shelter of him, eradicates all miseries. So that is the final statement of the Bhagavatam. It's looking forward into Kali Yuga. Actually, everything is very simple. Just chant Krishna's names, bow down to Krishna, surrender to Krishna, take shelter of him. Oh, I meant put the fan on. Yeah, just the one in the middle, at least here. Okay. At the same time, especially in the second canto, the Bhagavatam has its connection with the very ancient past and with the eternal Vedas. The Bhagavatam second canto, we'll see, we'll study today, how it has, it's like the interface, just like you have your computer, and you want to plug it into the printer. There's a circuitry inside on the motherboard that allows the computer to communicate with this other machine, your printer, or some other device, this interface. So although the Bhagavatam is especially connected with the modern age, Kali Yuga, it's got its interface, its connection with the eternal original Vedic literature, the Vedas. And that is especially manifested in the second canto. And that's maybe why the second canto is so complicated. Because of all the Vedic connections, things we're not familiar with. Allusions back to things from very ancient times in the second canto. Okay, now, because we only have 5 days for this class, and this is the first time I'm teaching the second canto course, so we're not going to be able to do everything exactly properly. We really should look at Prabhupada's purports while we're studying the verses and the commentaries, but we're not going to have time. And also, most of you probably don't have second cantos of your own. And we couldn't locate enough for everybody, so we just printed out the verses, the Sanskrit verses and the English translations, and we'll give them out to everybody for the first 3 chapters. So the homework assignment will be for tomorrow to read the first chapter, the verses and translations, because we're going to discuss them in detail in tomorrow's class. If you have access to the actual second canto and you find time to also read Prabhupada's purports, that's even better. Because I don't want to slight Prabhupada by ignoring his purports. Personally, when I was studying this material, reading the commentaries, I would read the commentaries of these three acharyas and then sit down and read Prabhupada's purport on the same verse. And I was always amazed how closely, especially in the second canto, how closely Prabhupada is basing his own purports on the commentaries. But unfortunately, we're not going to have time to examine that in the class. If you have access to the second canto, please read it also in preparation for the next day's class. Read Prabhupada's purports if you can get a hold of them. Anyway, we're looking now at the Vedic connection with this second canto. There's two kinds of, traditionally it's understood that there are two kinds of literatures, two kinds of shastra, scripture. They're called, we don't have the blackboard here, okay. They're called Shruti and Smriti. Everyone familiar with these words? Shruti, Smriti. They come from Sanskrit words, verbs. Shru means to hear. Smri means to remember. So the original Vedas are what we call Shruti. And the secondary literatures are called Smriti. Prabhupada, so many times, would proudly say that this Krishna consciousness is presenting Vedic civilization. That the books that we are teaching, these are Vedic literatures. This is a very bold claim. Because what everybody knows as the Vedas are very old. They're actually written in a different dialect of Sanskrit than the Sanskrit we know in the Bhagavatam. Practically a different language. And when an a non-devotee looks at the Vedas and then looks at the Bhagavatam, they see two different things. They don't see a connection. They say, here's this, these ancient Vedas that they say were written 2,500 years ago or 1,500 BC, 3,000 years ago, 3,500 years ago. And this Bhagavatam, which the mundane scholars say was written maybe 1,000 years ago. So they don't see any connection. You know, these wandering nomads who came from, you know, Siberia, wherever they came from, and invaded India, and they wrote the Rig Veda. You know, they were one people, and these later Brahmins, you know, who were, presenting the worship of Krishna and other demigods, they were different people. They were even totally different race. So they don't see a connection between the Vedas and the Puranas. But actually, it's there. Well, no matter what the mundane scholars think. But there is traditionally a difference between the Shruti, the original Vedas, and the Smritis. The difference is, Shruti is eternal, eternally unchanged. That means it's, Shruti means it's what's heard. Nobody wrote the Shruti, the Vedas. Shruti means Vedas. Original Vedas. Nobody wrote them. Not even God. Just like, yeah, Krishna is the origin of everything. But when did Krishna sit down and create the living entities? Never. Krishna says, na tvevaham jatu nasam, never was there a time when you didn't exist or me. So actually the living entities are co-eternal with God. You know, the living entities didn't come into being. God didn't take a lump of mud and make the jivas. The jivas were always there with Krishna. But they emanate from him. They expand out of him. So the jivas, nobody created the jivas, not even Krishna. Similarly, the Vedas are co-eternal with God. They always were there. Krishna didn't sit down and say, you know, we don't have any books to read, let's write some Vedas. He never, you know, there was never a time when even Krishna wrote the Vedas. They always were there. This is Shruti, original scripture. It's called Aparusheya. Nobody wrote them. Apurusha means person. No person wrote these books. And therefore, it's very important in the Vedic tradition that this literature, these Vedas, be passed down from generation to generation, unchanged. Not one syllable is allowed to be changed. And the Vedas are written in a special Vedic Sanskrit, which uses not only the, you know, the different sounds, but it has intonations, like melodies. Three different sounds. And the sounds, the pitches, the intonations must be exactly the same. You change one syllable, you say what, just like when the demigods wanted, not the demigods, who was demigod, wanted someone to defend Indra. And instead, he chanted once he wanted to create somebody who would come and destroy the deep demons on behalf of Indra. But he chanted one syllable wrong. It wasn't even the word wrong, he just got the wrong accent on it, on the word. And he said, and it came out meaning the opposite. And he got a demon to be the enemy of Indra. Just by changing the accent on one syllable. So it's very important that the Vedas be maintained, unchanged. That's one class of literature. Eternal, unchanging scripture that nobody ever wrote. So that has the highest authority. There can't be any imperfection in the Vedas. We have to accept everything they say as absolute truth, the final authority on everything. Then there are other literatures called Smritis. These are explanations of the Vedas. And the word smriti means what's remembered. The Vedic sages, they're called rishis. Rishi means seer. That means they meditate, and their first job, the first rishis, the first class rishis, their capacity was that they could, in their meditation, hear the Vedic mantras, these eternal mantras, because periodically, the Vedas are forgotten. So the sages have to sit down in their meditation and remember these mantras. So by the power of their meditation, they're able to perceive the eternal mantras that everybody else has forgotten. And then they speak them, and they're passed down into human society from the Vedic rishis. The rishis don't write the Vedas, they receive them in their meditation. It's like a television transponder. You have this microwave tower. The television programs originating from Bombay, but, you know, in Surat they have this transponder. It's a machine, you know, this is just a satellite, not satellite dish, but a microwave dish that catches the signal coming from Bombay and just passes it on. And every 10 kilometers they'll have another one of these transponders. So the sage, the rishi, is like that. He catches in his meditation the eternal sound, and he presents it to human society. But these same sages, or the second generation, the later generations of sages, the first class sages are the ones, the first ones, the original ones, are the ones who received the original Vedas. And then later sages, like Vyasadeva. Vyasadeva appeared only 5,000 years ago. He's a, in a, according to the time of sages, he's a young guy. Yeah. Just a young upstart. 5,000 years, that's nothing. Most of the big sages are millions of years old. So Vyasadeva, he's one of those who took the Vedic knowledge and presented it in his own words. This is called smriti. What the sages understand in that with their own intelligence and with their own words, they present in various scriptures. Like Vyasadeva, like other great sages. The Puranas and many other classes of literatures are supposed to be smriti. They're written by particular, very elevated human beings, but they have human authors, these great sages. Like the Vedanta Sutra by Vyasadeva. Explains the eternal Upanishads, essential portion of the Vedas that present the essence of knowledge, Upanishads. So Vyasadeva explained how to understand the general picture of the Upanishads. He smoothed out all the apparent contradictions of the Upanishads and explained everything in the Vedanta Sutra. That's his own composition. Vyasadeva also wrote Mahabharata. And the Puranas are also supposed to be considered smritis, compositions by various sages. Puranas are ancient histories of the universe. And Bhagavatam is one of the 18 major Puranas. So, at least officially, the Bhagavatam is in the second category. It's smriti. It's a secondary literature. It was supposedly written by Vyasadeva 5,000 years ago. That means that it's of secondary authority. If it's smriti, then it's not as authoritative as shruti, as the original Vedas. So traditionally, in previous ages, first-class Brahmins, their education was primarily studying the Vedas. And then other literatures, that was just, you know, added on. But the main essence of their education, years and years of study, was memorizing and studying the meaning of the Vedas, the original Vedas. In previous ages, Kali Yuga were less intelligent. Even the best Brahmins among us can hardly understand the Vedas, what to speak of memorizing them, what to speak of properly being able to interpret and explain them. Practically nobody has the intelligence, the capacity to study the Vedas properly or teach them in Kali Yuga. So we have a different situation in Kali Yuga. This is explained by Srila Jiva Goswami in his Tattvasandarbha. In Kali Yuga, because practically nobody can even read through even one whole Veda, what to speak of four Vedas and all their supplements. And nobody can memorize them, and nobody can understand what they mean. And even if you find in Kali Yuga some exceptional person, great scholar, who can give a very nice explanation of the Vedas, you'll find some other scholar that has an opposite explanation. There's so many disagreements between authorities in Kali Yuga. So therefore, it's practically impossible to get access to the original Vedas in Kali Yuga. Therefore, Jiva Goswami says, in this age, The epic histories like Mahabharata, Ramayana, and the Puranas become very important. This is our only real access to the original Vedic knowledge in Kali Yuga, is through these smritis. So Bhagavatam is supposed to be one of them. But there are other Puranas too, and we have Mahabharata, and we have Ramayana, so many books. What's so special about the Bhagavatam? This is what Jiva Goswami wrote his first Sandarbha, the Tattva Sandarbha, to establish. Why the Bhagavatam is so important, even in comparison to the other Puranas and Mahabharata. Why the Bhagavatam is the one book that's really relevant for Kali Yuga, that really presents the essence of Vedic knowledge. That's claimed by the Bhagavatam itself. Nigama kalpa taro galitam palam. This Bhagavatam is the ripened fruit of the tree of Vedic knowledge. Of course, any book can make a bold claim for itself, just, you know, self-advertisement. But the Bhagavatam doesn't, you know, play games. It doesn't say things that aren't true. And it claims, the Bhagavatam claims for itself right at the beginning that this Bhagavatam, in comparison to anything else, is special. It is the ripened fruit of all the entire tree of Vedic literature. And it's claiming, therefore, direct connection with the Vedas. This is not some thing that just came out of Vyasadeva's head only 5,000 years ago. This is directly Vedic knowledge. And it's the cream of all Vedic knowledge. The essence, undistorted. The perfect cream of the Vedas. And that's what the Bhagavatam says about itself. So, Srila Jiva Goswami very vigorously defends this opinion of the Bhagavatam, that it actually is. In fact, he makes a very bold presentation to prove that the Bhagavatam, although it's officially smriti and everybody thinks it's just another Purana, Srila Jiva Goswami in the Tattva Sandarbha gives a proof that Bhagavatam is actually shruti. It's actually eternal, unchanging literature, equal to the original Vedas. This is, Jiva Goswami gives a very convincing proof of this, but it's very difficult for anybody who is not one of our sampradaya, who doesn't have faith in the words of our acharyas, to believe this. As far as everybody else is concerned, even most Vaishnavas, Bhagavatam is a smriti. It's a secondary literature. But Jiva Goswami has proven it's actually, secretly, although it's publicly just a smriti, the secret information is that the Bhagavatam is really shruti. So, what I'll do is I'm going to read right out of the text of Tattva Sandarbha. I'll read the translation. This is about halfway through the Tattva Sandarbha, paragraph number 26. And I'm not going to read the original Sanskrit, I'll just read the translation for you. So Jiva Goswami is describing how Shukadeva was speaking the Bhagavatam to Parikshit Maharaj. So Jiva Goswami says that both Vyasadeva and Narada were present at that time. Although they were Shukadeva's spiritual master and his grand spiritual master, still Srimad Bhagavatam, as it emanated from Shukadeva's mouth, seemed to Vyasadeva and Narada as if it was something they never heard before. Thus, it is to be understood, Shukadeva acted as a spiritual master, preceptor, even for the two of them, Vyasadeva and Narada Muni. It has been said at the beginning of the Bhagavatam, Shukamukhad amitur javya samyutam. By being touched by Shukadeva's mouth, this Bhagavatam, this fruit, has become soft and full of nectar. So this is evidence that the Bhagavatam is superior to all other scriptures. When we hear statements that the Matsya Purana or some other Purana is the greatest Purana, because maybe the Matsya Purana says that about itself. This is the best of all Puranas. But that's only relative. In fact, Jiva Goswami says, why do we need to say anything more? Srimad Bhagavatam is the exact image, the exact incarnation of Krishna himself. And he goes on to say, Bhagavatam states in its own first canto, Krishna svadamo pagate dharma gyana nibhiksaha kalao nashtra jishamesha puranarko dinoditaha. Bhagavatam 1.3.43. This Srimad Bhagavatam is as brilliant as the sun, and it has arisen just after the departure of Lord Krishna to his own abode, accompanied by religion, knowledge, etc. Persons who have lost their vision due to the dense darkness of ignorance in the age of Kali shall get light from this Purana. Then Jiva Goswami continues, therefore we see that this scripture is uniquely endowed with all good qualities. This is shown by such statements as Dharma Projita Kaito Votra, second verse of the first canto, that in this book all cheating conceptions, all dishonest conceptions of religion are kicked out. And then Jiva Goswami quotes from the Mukta Pala, which was written by a Mayavadi, Vopadev, and another Mayavadi called Hemadri. They both give this verse. The statement, Veda Puranam Kavyam Cha Prabhur Mitram Priyeva Cha Bodayantiti Hi Prahus Trivrit Bhagavatam Punaha. That means the Vedas, the Puranas, and poetry. These three classes of literature. Vedas, Puranas, we were discussing the Vedas and the Puranas. And then also there's poetic literature written by different poets. Like Kalidas lived in, I don't know, 11th century or so. No, lived 9th century, Kalidas. So recent, you know, more or less recent poets wrote great dramas glorifying different pastimes of the Lord, like Raghuvamsa and so on, about the ancestors of Lord Ramachandra. So it's great poetry too. So three classes of literature, Vedas, Puranas, and poetry. They give instruction in three different ways. Like a master, like a friend, and like a lover, respectively. The Bhagavatam, however, teaches in all three ways. So the Vedas are like a master giving instructions. You do this, you do that. And the Puranas are like a friend, telling you stories, trying to encourage you in various ways, for the same purpose, but instructing in a different way, in a friendly way. And poetry is there to give you pleasure. It's like a very intimate lover. But the Bhagavatam is functioning in all three ways. It's giving instruction in the same way as the Vedas, like a master, like the Puranas, like a friend, and like, you know, very pleasurable poetry, like a lover. So you don't see this kind of description given about other Puranas. This makes the Bhagavatam very special. So even if Jiva Goswami continues, so even if as some people think, other Puranas are subordinate to the authority of the Vedas, Srimad Bhagavatam directly denies this idea in regards to itself. Srimad Bhagavatam is saying that its own authority is independent. It doesn't even depend on being supported by statements of the Vedas. In other words, Bhagavatam claims its own authority independently. Thus its position is that of the highest Shruti authority. This is what Jiva Goswami is saying. And then he quotes the verse from the Bhagavatam, questioned by Shonaka Rishi. Katam va pandaveyasya rajarshir muninasaha samvada samabhutata yatraisha satvati shrutihi. So Shonaka is asking, how did it happen as Parikshit met this great sage, making it possible for this Shruti text, for the pure Vaishnavas to be manifest? He's asking, how did it come about that this king and this, you know, Brahmavadi, this impersonless, how did they get together and then have some conversation? And what was manifested is this Bhagavatam. And then Shonaka is asking that question. He calls the Bhagavatam Sattvati Shruti. It's the Shruti for the Vaishnavas. Okay. That's Jiva Goswami's explanation of the real position of the Bhagavatam. That it's eternal literature. It's equal to the Vedas. And the Bhagavatam is explaining the Vedas. Because the statement was here that the Bhagavatam is giving instruction in, like the Vedas, but also like the Puranas, also like poetry. Bhagavatam is not only telling us what to do, but it's explaining everything to us very clearly and in a very palatable way. And then it is full of rasa. What's the essence of poetry? If you study the different textbooks, there are dozens of different textbooks on poetics, Kavya Shastra, written in different generations. And there are lots of different opinions. All sorts of debates going on throughout the centuries. What's the essence of poetry? What is poetry really about? So some poets and some persons have written textbooks on poetry, going back to the first century AD. Some of them say that figurative speech, using speech language in unusual ways, that's the essence of poetry. And some of them say no, that style, having, you know, a very vivid style, that's the essence of poetry. But another opinion is that the essence of poetry is rasa. If there's no rasa, if there's no transcendental ecstasy, in connection with the personality of Godhead, expressing personal relationships with the Supreme Person. If there's no rasa, then the poetry is dead. It's not poetry. Real poetry is rasatmika. So the Bhagavatam definitely is full of rasa. Not just in the 10th canto, but throughout. For those who know how to taste rasa, they can appreciate that the Bhagavatam, even in the parts that seem mundane, is full of this ecstatic attraction to Krishna. And this all these different kinds of personal relationships with Krishna are manifested in every shloka of the Bhagavatam. Therefore, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu constantly was eager to hear Srimad Bhagavatam, especially from his devotees like Gadadhar Pandit and Raghunath Bhatta Goswami. One of Lord Chaitanya's favorite pastimes was to simply sit with his devotees and hear someone like Gadadhar Pandit recite the Bhagavatam. And it's not that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu only wanted to hear the 10th canto, only about the Rasalila. You would think so, because he was, you know, promoted the worship of Radha and Krishna, you know, almost exclusively in his preaching. But he was eager. He wanted to hear over and over again the pastimes of Dhruva Maharaj, of Prahlad Maharaj. He was a worshipper of the Bhagavatam, the whole thing, not just the five chapters about the Rasalila. So that same Bhagavatam is full of poetry, therefore, full of rasa, the real poetry. The poetry of Krishna Katha. Krishna and Krishna's devotees. But also, it has its Vedic connection. The essential instructions of the Vedas are being presented very completely and very effectively in Srimad Bhagavatam. That's stated in the Garuda Purana, quoted by Jiva Goswami. So here's the Garuda Purana, a different Purana, praising Srimad Bhagavatam. And in the Garuda Purana there's a statement, Arto yam Brahma Sutranam Bharat Arta Vinirnayaha Gayatri Bhashya Rupo Sau Vedarta Paribrimhitaha Purananam Samarupa Sakshat Bhagavato Ritaha Dvadasha Skanda Yukto Yam Shatavicheda Samyutaha.
Granto shtadasha sahasram shri bhagavata abhidaha.
So the Garuda Purana says that this is the most complete of the Puranas. It is the purport of the Vedanta Sutra. It establishes the meaning of the Mahabharata. It's also a commentary on the Gayatri Mantra. And it completes the meaning. It fills in the purport of the Vedas. It's like the Samaveda among all the Puranas. And it's spoken directly by the personality of Godhead, Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam was spoken a long time ago by Naranarayan Rishi to Sanak Kumar in a different sampradaya. And then it was spoken by Vyasadeva just before the beginning of Kali Yuga, who's also an incarnation of Krishna. So this work with 12 cantos, hundreds of chapters, and 18,000 verses is called Srimad Bhagavatam. So it's stated here that it's full of the purports of the Vedas. Especially for Kali Yuga, we can't understand the Vedas directly. Almost nobody can in Kali Yuga. But the Vedas are completely explained by Srimad Bhagavatam. Jiva Goswami gives the analogy that if you have a gold bangle and it's broken, don't let the jeweler fix it with some cheap tin. That's useless. You don't want to fix a gold bangle. You want to use real gold to repair the broken piece. Not some cheap metal. So the Vedas can, when the meaning of the Vedas were lost, you need something equal to the Vedas to explain them. Just like you need real gold to fix a gold bangle. Okay, so, why don't we pause for a moment. Anybody have any questions or comments on what we've done so far? Yeah. That the verses are coming from Bhagavatam? Yeah. Well, okay. No, that's one, that's discussed by Baladeva Dibhushan, this question that, you're trying to prove the authority of the Bhagavatam and you're quoting from the Bhagavatam. Jiva Goswami, or Baladeva Dibhushan is defending Jiva Goswami, that because the Bhagavatam has independent authority, it can do that. It can quote from itself to establish its own authority. But Jiva Goswami, but also I'm quoting out of context. This is halfway through the Tapasandarbha. Up to this point, Jiva Goswami very, very systematically was proving, coming up to the point of proving the position of Bhagavatam without quoting from the Bhagavatam. Then when he finally convinces us that the Bhagavatam is the most valuable literature, then he starts quoting from it. So I'm reading from the almost the second half of the, about 40% through the Tapasandarbha, when he's already proved the authority of the Bhagavatam. And now he's starting to quote from it. Before he was quoting from other Puranas, from the Vedas and from Upanishads. If you read Tapasandarbha, you'll see how he does it very systematically. Yeah. First he proves the authority of the Bhagavatam, then he uses it. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Etasya mahato bhutasya nikshvasitam yareta rigveda yajurveda samaveda. What is this? Itihasa purana. Yeah. He says, this is the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. If you don't believe that the Upanishads are eternal, you should, and you think that they were written at various times. Okay, at least the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is considered one of the oldest ones. And in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, it's stated here that this is the breath of the Supreme Being. The Vedas, Rig Veda, Sama Veda, Atharva Veda, Yajur Veda, and the corollaries, the six sciences that explain the Vedas, like grammar and so on, and astrology. And then the Itihasas and Puranas also. So in the same breath of Narayan are emanating the Vedas and also Puranas and the epics, Mahabharata, Ramayana. That's Upanishad.
And the statement that the Itihasa and Purana are the Panchama Veda, the fifth Veda, is also coming from Upanishads. And Jiva Goswami quoted these verses. You read Tattva Sandarbha, you'll see so many statements from Shruti, from Upanishads especially, that systematically explain to us why the Bhagavatam for us in the modern age is essential. If we want to understand this Vedic knowledge, we have to go to the Bhagavatam. Okay. Any other questions? Yes. Well, I know that Prabhupada quoted that. I don't remember where it comes from. Maybe someone else does. Actually, if you're not free from sex desire, you should not go beyond this first two cantos. At the same time, Prabhupada lectured on sixth canto, seventh canto, eighth canto, in public. And he published up to the tenth canto. And wanted his disciples to get, told Pajumna to finish the rest of the Bhagavatam. And he had devotees distributing, in the airports and on the streets, sixth cantos, eighth cantos, ninth cantos. So we have to reconcile these two points. The statement that you're not supposed to read it, and Prabhupada not only having his intimate disciples read it, but passing out these later cantos to people on the street. So, I think the difference is here that when it's presented with Prabhupada's purports, Prabhupada is presenting in his purports the commentaries of Sridhar Swami, Jiva Goswami, Vishwanath Chakravarti. So when even the later cantos of Bhagavatam, when they're explained by the pure Vaishnavas, the followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, then you can even give them to any person on the street, and they'll get transcendental benefit. The mercy of the Bhagavatam is being extended, being stretched beyond the normal limits by the empowerment, the special power of the Vaishnavacharyas in the line of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It's being made accessible to everybody. Normally, nobody should touch this. Nobody should touch, anything beyond the second canto. It was not free from sex desire. But by Lord Chaitanya's mercy, it's being made available. And certainly, with that special dispensation, we should take advantage of it. Yeah. We should immerse ourselves in the rest of this Bhagavatam, the whole thing, 12 cantos, and give it out to everybody, distribute it. Yes, Mother? Yes. Yes. That's why we shouldn't think that, okay, I read Prabhupada's books. I've already read through the whole Bhagavatam and CC. I read them 10 years ago. Because 10 years later, if you've made some advancement, you're going to get a lot more out of it reading it again. So we should be constantly reading Prabhupada's purports. Because as we become more Krishna conscious, we're going to discover what's actually in this book. When Vishwanath Chakravarti presents the verses of Bhagavatam, he's seeing the very intimate ecstatic rasas of prema bhakti in every verse. So gradually we can also come somewhere near that stage of appreciating the real nectar in the Bhagavatam. Okay. Unfortunately, I don't have, I've got no realization like that, we're going to just look at some verses and analyze some commentaries. But that'll give us at least some impetus to study the Bhagavatam deeply. And someday we'll be able to appreciate the real nectar that's in there. Okay, yes.
Yes. You were saying that when you have some commentary that is significant, that it's not Shruti.
No, the Vedas are Shruti.
Yeah, but so at once, when immediately you get some section of these Vedas,
Yes.
Discourse.
Yes.
And, you are getting similitude, not exclusive.
Why? You're saying if you get the if you look at the Vedas, then you're going to, why is it Smriti and not Shruti?
Because they are already with my Smriti.
Okay. Well, no. Well, it's actually considered in previous ages. Did everyone hear the question? If it's written, if you look at the Vedas in a book, does that mean it's not Smriti anymore? Well, it's not Shruti anymore, but it is. Just like the Ganga water is always pure. No matter, you know, how you try to contaminate it. The devotees used to tell me in Calcutta that it's not Ganga water anymore because they chlorinate the water. So they say it's not, but how could it, because you added chlorine, it's not Ganga water anymore? The same thing. You can take the Vedas and do this and that to them, but they're still the eternal Vedas. Although it's considered an aparad to, learn the Vedas from a book. In previous ages, the education had to be by word of mouth. You had to hear the Vedas, not read them. It was considered aparad, an offense, to study from a book. But in Kali Yuga, we don't have the brains to do it otherwise. We have to study out of books. So, okay, we're excused. But normally, it's offensive to not receive the Vedas by oral reception. But still, it doesn't change the potency or the purity of the Vedas. They're still Shruti. As long as you don't change the words. If you change the words, then that's distorted. Okay, a couple more. Okay, shall we continue? Yeah. This is what Jiva Goswami is proving to us. It's secret information. Yeah, it's officially Smriti. It's a Purana, it's supposed to be a Smriti. But actually it's eternal. It's like this, yeah. Nothing changes. It's, yes. When Shukadev is a parrot. Shukadev means parrot. The parrot simply repeats what he heard. It doesn't change anything. Shukadev Goswami spoke to 18,000 verses. Those 18,000 verses have always existed. Even the verses spoken by Shukadev Goswami. When Vyasadeva spoke the Bhagavatam to Shukadev, he spoke the whole thing, 18,000 verses, including the verses that Shukadev was going to speak later on to Parikshit. That's part of the whole Bhagavatam. Shukadev doesn't begin speaking until here in the second canto. But Vyasadeva recited to his son Shukadev the whole thing, including the first canto, not just starting from the second canto or the third canto. The whole thing. We learned that Brahma in the Tathasandarbha. That Shukadev spoke the entire 18,000 verses, including what he hadn't spoken yet. Yeah, because he's seeing into the future, and he knows, you know, that Bhagavatam was already there, including the verses he hadn't spoken yet. And he simply spoke, you know, recited the script, just repeated it without changing it. It's not the Bhagavatam. There are 18 Puranas, but that 18 Puranas, that's the edited version created by Vyasadeva at the beginning of Dwapara Yuga, and that happens at the beginning at the end of every Dwapara Yuga, beginning of every Kali Yuga. But there is a single Purana that's 1 billion verses long. One Purana, and all the Puranas are included within it. And on the heavenly planets, they're still reading that billion verse version. It's not just the Bhagavatam, it's all the Puranas together in one volume. But they're condensed at the end of Dwapara Yuga by Vyasadeva to 400,000 verses. 18 different Puranas. Bhagavatam's one of them. 18,000 verses. So that Bhagavatam, that eternal Bhagavatam is there. It's part of that 1 billion volume. Yeah, unabridged version. It's still in there. Okay, two more questions. Yes, Pooh? Okay, yes. Okay, there's a modern branch of philosophy called hermeneutics. Hermeneutics, it's the science of interpretation.
an explanation of what does it mean to translate something. Maybe many of us are involved in translating from Russian or other languages, you know, translating Prabhupada's books from one language to another. What does translation really mean? So in hermeneutics, they explain, theoretically, but it makes sense, that there's different levels of translation. When you translate something from one language to another, that's obviously a translation. You're changing the language. And you're going to either add or subtract something. If you're a good translator, you'll make it better than the original, your translation. If you're a really brilliant translator, going from one language to another. But another way of translating is to simply repeat something without changing one word. If you are self-realized, if you're brilliant or self-realized, then simply by speaking the script like an actor, reciting, you know, a Shakespeare play, playing the role of Hamlet, he just recites the lines, to be or not to be, that is the question. If he does it with real understanding, then he's going to add something just by repeating the words. So Shukadeva Goswami simply read the script. He didn't change one word. But Shukamukad Amrajasamritam, by being touched by the lips of Shukadeva, so much meaning was added. And that's recognized by these modern philosophers, that it's a kind of translation, to simply repeat the words unchanged, but to do it with realization adds a lot of meaning to a text. It's passing through your intelligence, and your realizations are being added to it, even without changing one word. It's done any time a good actor performs a play. And it was done when Shukadeva spoke the Bhagavatam without changing one word. Okay. Yeah. Krishna doesn't come, yes. The Bhagavatam, well, what the Bhagavatam is describing for us is recent history, something that happened 5,000 years ago. But just like we read about the pastimes of the Ramachandra, they actually happened 2 million years ago, and still they're remembered. And we have the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, and there's description of Ramachandra's pastimes in all the Puranas also. So like that, Bhagavatam, even when Krishna hasn't been around for 1 billion years or 100 billion years, still the Bhagavatam is there. And devotees are still remembering him, even 1 billion or 100 billion years after his appearance. The Bhagavatam is eternal. It may be lost for some time. You know, there may be times in history where nobody has the Bhagavatam. It's not available. But it's always there, somewhere. And therefore, Krishna's fame is undying. So there's always some, if you can find the Bhagavatam and hear it from somebody, then you'll get access to Krishna's pastimes, even if they happened 100 billion years ago. Okay, last question, because we have to finish today's material. Yeah.
How is it that this is a single space of the Vedas, Puranas, and poetry came from around Bhagavatam?
He's writing a commentary on the Bhagavatam. This Vopadeva was attached to the Bhagavatam. He wrote a whole book called Muktapala, which is his explanation of the Bhagavatam. We don't like his explanation because he's a Mayavadi. He's got so many Mayavadi ideas. But he's a great scholar. Yeah, a very famous grammarian. And Jiva Goswami likes to quote from him once in a while. Sometimes he comes up with a good idea. He's a Mayavadi, but sometimes he presented a good idea. And this was just a verse that he quoted from some other scripture. It wasn't his own statement. Yeah, so once in a while, Vopadeva is famous, so many people know him, so sometimes Jiva Goswami quotes from him. When he comes up with a good idea. Yeah. I'm sorry, you have a question?
It's very small
question. Yeah. Thanks. Yes, I'm fine.
What you were saying about Shukadeva Goswami, about his addition to the Bhagavatam by...
Just by speaking it.
Yeah. Is that the same as him here in the Shastra from the realized devotee of Krishna?
Yes. Yeah. Like reading Prabhupada's purports. Yeah. He is adding a little bit of his own in his purports. But mostly Prabhupada's purports are based on the Sanskrit commentaries of the Acharyas following Lord Chaitanya. So, to hear it repeated word for word, or with some explanation added, makes it more and more relishable. It's like ever increasing. It's not static. It becomes more and more full of meaning with each generation of pure presentation. If somebody starts giving their own interpretation and twisting things, then it becomes less relishable, or it becomes useless. But as long as the parampara is pure, then each generation of additional explanation adds more and more. It's like ever growing. Yeah.
How can one judge whether the explanations are coming from this?
You can see by the result. You know, are the disciples of that devotee becoming pure devotees of Krishna? Are they giving up their materialism? Are they developing love of God? You have to test a guru by his disciples. You test the parampara by the history of the parampara. You know, this Gaudiya Vaishnava Sampradaya, what kind of devotees has it produced? What kind of Krishna consciousness has it spread throughout the world? I mean, if we can look at the history of the great acharyas and Lord Chaitanya, what they've accomplished. Okay, we have to go on. Got a little more material to cover, a lot more. Good half hour's worth. Yeah. First of all, this is the homework. This is just the verses, Sanskrit verses and English translations of the first chapter. So the homework assignment is at least minimum read through these. Because we're going to discuss them, and we're going to look at the verses sort of word by word here and there, look at some of the individual phrases tomorrow. So can you pass these around? There might be a few extra. Let's see. I think we have enough room. And if you have any extras, give them back to me. And if you have access to the actual second canto, try to take the opportunity to read Prabhupada's purports for this first chapter also, or at least the first few verses. Okay. So we want to look at how the Bhagavatam is actually an explanation of the Vedas, and how there's a lot of allusions to and a lot of explanations of things that are found in the original Vedas, or the same themes, the same topics that are discussed in the Rig Veda and the others are also explained in this, especially in the second canto of the Bhagavatam. Let's look at the contents of the first seven chapters of the Bhagavatam, of the second canto. First chapter, Shukadev starts giving answers to Parikshit's questions. And the first thing he talks about after some discussion of how he should remember Krishna at the time of death. But then he becomes specific and he starts describing how to meditate on the universal form of the Lord. Of course, we understand from the history, to explain the history of the universe in the Bhagavatam and other Shastras, that the Supreme Lord Narayan expands himself into three Purushas, Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshay Vishnu, Kshiradakshay Vishnu. Says Mahavishnu lies down on the causal ocean. It's actually a corner of the spiritual world, but the material energy is residing in that corner of the spiritual sky. Therefore, it's like a dark cloud in one corner of the Vaikuntha sky. And Lord Narayan lies down in that causal ocean, and he glances at the material energy, at Maya, the presiding deity, Maya. And that's the only contact he makes with his external energy. He doesn't touch her. He simply looks at her once. But in that glance is created all the potency for creation, including the living entities themselves are injected in the womb of Maya through that glance. And then while Mahavishnu is lying in that ocean, at the same time he's sleeping, he's doing all this in his sleep, in his Yogamaya dream. And while he's asleep, he's perspiring, and that perspiration, those bubbles of perspiration, are the eggs of the universals, the universes, the different shells that make up the universes. And they're floating on this water, and then the Lord enters every single one of them to bring them to life. Nothing can happen unless the Lord Vishnu himself inspires it to happen, unless he gets involved. So he enters each universe as Garbhadakshay Vishnu, separately in each universe. And he lies down in the water inside each of those universal shells. And then he's lying there for 1,000 Divya Yugas, and from his lotus navel sprouts a lotus stem. and a lotus grows on the end of that stem, and four-headed Brahma appears, takes his birth. So that lotus stem is like the blueprint for the creation. Everything in subtler form is contained within that lotus stem. So that is considered the universal form, the body of the universe. So the meditation on that universal form is described in the first chapter of the first canto. And then and that is a Vedic topic, definitely. In the Rig Veda, we have the famous Purusha Sukta. What is the Purusha Sukta talking about? Sahasra Shirsha Purushaha Sahasrakshat Sahasrapat Sabhumim Vishvato Vritva Atyatishtad Dashangulam. We have the Purusha, the Supreme Person, with thousands of heads, thousands of arms and legs, thousands of faces. This is Gaurabhodakshaya Vishnu. Maybe you don't usually think of him as having thousands of heads and arms and legs, but he does, at least in one of his expansions. Gaurabhodakshaya Vishnu. And he's lying down on the causal ocean, and this lotus stem comes up and actually breaks through the shell of the universe, Atyatishtha Dashangulam, and rises to the height of 10 of his own thumbs. And then it's described in the Purusha Sukta, in the others, there's 16 verses, how the universe is created out of this body of Gaurabhodakshaya Vishnu. That the different demigods and all the planets and all the elements of creation and all the different species of life, everything is coming out of Gaurabhodakshaya Vishnu's own body. That's what the Purusha Sukta is describing. And then, the whole creation is maintained by the performance of sacrifice. Now the material world runs on the basis of karma, of work. You know, we know in our own material life, if we don't work, we don't eat. So the material world is not maintained unless work is done. But karma really means Vedic sacrifice. That's the original meaning of the word karma, not just work, working in a factory, but doing Vedic sacrifice. That's the Vedic conception of civilized work. Uncivilized people, they go work in a factory. Yeah. Or the animals just, graze in the jungle for food. But intelligent beings, they study the Vedas and they perform Vedic sacrifice. That's the work. That's the kind of work that maintains the universe. Not the work in the factory. Or not the foraging in the jungle by the animals. The demigods and intelligent human beings, they perform sacrifice. But in the beginning of creation, to start the whole show, someone had to start performing sacrifice. The demigods, they were created from Mahavishnu. They entered the elements to preside over them, but they didn't know what to do. They knew they had to perform sacrifice, but what are they going to perform sacrifice with? Now, where are they going to get the ingredients? They weren't available. So they had to take the ingredients for sacrifice right out of the body of Gaurabhodakshaya Vishnu. That's what the Purusha Sukta is describing. How the demigods performed the first sacrifice using the different parts of Gaurabhodakshaya Vishnu's body for the ingredients for the sacrifice. And then the mundane scholars read this and they interpret that this Purusha Sukta is a description of a human sacrifice. You know, some barbarians, you know, ripped apart somebody and performed a sacrifice. But this Purusha is Gaurabhodakshaya Vishnu. It's not some ordinary person being slaughtered by cannibals. So this is being described by Shukadeva Goswami in his very first chapter of instructions. The same meditation, the meditation on that same Purusha and the universal form that comes from his body, all the different parts of the universe that are actually coming from the limbs of his own body, that meditation on that, the process of meditating on that aspect of God and his creation, is described, first of all, by Shukadeva Goswami in this first chapter of the second canto. Definitely a Vedic topic, Rig Veda topic. And then the second chapter describes a different kind of meditation. It's actually more advanced. And we'll discuss today and tomorrow and the next day the different levels of realization of these different meditations.
But this, on a higher level than the meditation on the universal form, is the meditation on the supersoul. There's two kinds of supersouls. Garbhat Akshaya Vishnu is supersoul. Kshirad Akshaya Vishnu, the third Vishnu, is also supersoul. But Garbhat Akshaya Vishnu, the second Vishnu, is the supersoul of the whole universe. This universal body, whose body is it? It's a material body. God doesn't have a material body. God, Krishna, Vishnu never has a material body. And there's another rule of the economics of creation, is that material nature doesn't create a body unless somebody wants it. Just like if some construction company builds houses, but they're not going to build a house until someone commissions it. Someone pays them the money, then they'll build a house. Someone wants a house, they'll build it. So material nature creates bodies only when somebody wants them. Who wanted this universal form for a body? The answer is Brahma, the first living being. It's his body. He wanted the whole universe for his body. And Maya, under Krishna's direction, produced from herself the universal form, this Virat Rupa, as Brahma's body. That's his body. He later takes birth again on the lotus stem with four heads, but first he has this Virat Rupa as his subtle body. That's explained by the commentators in the second and third canto of the Bhagavatam. It's Brahma's body. The Virat Rupa, the universal form, is really Brahma's body. But every material body has a jiva and also a supersoul sitting with the jiva in the heart. So Garbhat Akshaya Vishnu is the supersoul in the universal form. It's Brahma's material body, and Vishnu's there in the form of Garbhat Akshaya Vishnu as the, what we call, Samashti Paramatma. Samashti means the whole thing, everything. He's the supersoul. Garbhat Akshaya Vishnu is the supersoul of the whole universe. Or, in other words, of the universal form, which is Brahma's, Lord Brahma's body. And then Brahma creates all the other bodies for everybody else, individual small bodies, parts of the universe, demigods, human beings, animals. And Vishnu, in the third form, Kshirad Akshaya Vishnu, he becomes the Vyashti supersoul, the individual supersoul in every little body. So there's two different kinds of supersouls. The Garbhat Akshaya Vishnu is the supersoul of the whole universe at once, and Kshirad Akshaya Vishnu is the supersoul of every individual being. So the second chapter of the second canto describes meditation on this second kind of supersoul, the supersoul inside your own body. Yogis are taught how to meditate on that supersoul, especially in some of the Puranas. No, I'm sorry, some of the Upanishads. Not all Upanishads, but some Upanishads focus on description of how to meditate on that supersoul in your heart. And of course there's Smritis written by yogis, textbooks in yoga. There's Patanjali Yoga Sutra and more recent books describing how to perform that yoga. But originally it's described in the Upanishads, in the Shrutis, how to meditate on the universal form. Those Upanishads are also part of the Vedas. And that's described in the second, by Shukadeva in his second chapter. Then the third chapter talks about demigod worship. That's definitely another Vedic topic. The Rig Veda seems, if you read it, just read it not knowing anything about it, it seems to be all about glorification of different demigods, like Indra and Soma, Surya, Varuna, and others, many others. Seems to be a pantheistic, just menagerie of so many different demigods being glorified. And that's all the Rig Veda seems to be. And that's supposed to be the original Veda. That has to be explained. How is the absolute truth being explained in the Vedas when it seems to be some pantheistic, flattery of different demigods? All different demigods, doesn't seem to be any coherence. No overriding principle. Who's in charge or who's the real Lord or anything. It just, so many different personalities being glorified for different reasons without any hierarchy of who's greater than who. But that's explained. It's explained by Vyasadeva very philosophically in the Vedanta Sutra.
what the real nature of the Absolute Truth is. It's explained in the Upanishads, but that's a very difficult explanation. But the Bhagavatam second canto is also, and other parts of the Bhagavatam is also explaining how to understand this glorification of demigods in the Vedas. And what are the real positions of the demigods and what's their relationship to the Supreme Person? That is described in the third chapter of the second canto. Demigod worship and worship of the Supreme Person. What's the connection? You know, what's authentic and what's the value of these different kinds of worship? That Shukadev discusses in that third chapter. And those are the three chapters we're going to try to cover in these 5 days. But then he goes on. There's more. In the fourth chapter, Parikshit Maharaj is asking questions about how does the Purusha, that Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, how does he create the universe? And then Shukadev is getting ready to answer him in this fourth chapter, and he first offers his prayers. He wants to, before he starts saying anything, an answer, he wants to offer homage to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, especially in the form of the Purusha, the Creator. And so those prayers are there in the fourth chapter. And then the other three chapters are in order to answer Parikshit Maharaj's questions about how did the Supreme Lord create this universe. In the fifth, sixth, and seventh chapters of the second canto, Shukadev tells about an earlier conversation about the same questions when Narada Muni went to his father, Lord Brahma, and asked him also about the creation. So Narada and Brahma are talking in the fifth canto about the creation from the Purusha. And then the sixth chapter Prabhupada entitles Purusha Sukta Confirmed, which is practically a commentary on the Purusha Sukta, explaining it verse by verse. And then the seventh chapter switches from that, or graduates from the topic of creation from Garbhodakshaya Vishnu to how the Lord appears in this world in his different pastime incarnations. So this is a much more elevated topic. Brahma, talking to Narada, presents this in the seventh chapter. The major incarnations of the Supreme Lord performing his different pastimes. This is all connected together. And so we're trying to study how Srimad Bhagavatam is explaining to us, even if we've never read the Vedas, we never have looked at them, but by studying second canto, we can understand the essence of a very complex description of the Vedas. All about this creation of the universe and the universal form and about the different demigods and how they're worshipped. And what this has to do with the pastimes of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and the process of pure devotional service, the connection among all these different ideas, these different conceptions of spirituality. This is all explained very systematically in the second canto, especially in these first seven chapters. Our Vaishnavacharyas, going back to Ramanujacharya, they've discussed these things very nicely. Ramanujacharya, he explained in books like the Vedarta Sangraha that the demigods are actually different parts of the body of Garbhodakshaya Vishnu, of the universal form. Indra is his arms. It's stated in the Vedas. In the Purusha Sukta says it. Indra is his arms. The sun and the moon are his eyes, and so on. And then there's other statements that, for example, that all the names, Ramanujacharya made the claim that all the names of everybody are actually names of Vishnu. But especially the names of the demigods. What does Indra mean? Indra means king. But Krishna is the supreme king, Ekendra. Or, when Krishna defeated the pride of Indra, Indra tried to destroy Vrindavan and poured rain on Vrindavan for 7 days, and Krishna, by lifting Govardhan Hill, defeated his attempt. And then Indra, very embarrassed, came to Govindakund on the side of Govardhan to try to offer his apologies. And to make up for it, Lord Brahma, Indra, and all the demigods performed the Abhishek of Krishna, coronating him as the king of the demigods. And Surabhi, Mother Surabhi, the mother of all the cows, came. And she brought the Ganga water in and carried in her... No, I'm sorry, that was Airavata. Brought the Ganga water. Anyway, Mother Surabhi came and offered her prayers at that time. Airavata performed the Abhishek, and all the demigods performed the ceremonial bathing of Krishna, and Mother Surabhi praised Krishna. Sapatu na Indra Govam. May you protect us. You are our Indra of the cows. Indra Govam. No. Indra is there. Okay, he's king of heaven. But for us, you're our Indra, the Indra of the king of the cows. King of the cowherd men. So that word, that name, Indra Govam, turn it around, it becomes Govinda. This is where Krishna, according to Sukadeva Goswami, got the name Govinda. He's the original Indra. He's the original Surya. He's the original Soma. These names are, and even the different powers and the different bodily forms of the demigods are really Krishna's. So there's actually a statement somewhere, I can't find it, I can't remember where it is, but there's a statement that Lord Keshava loaned his own, gave on loan his own names and forms and his own powers to all the different demigods who are his servants. They're his names, they're his bodily forms, they're his powers. So this is what's explained in the Vedas, in the Purusha Sukta especially. It's like condensed essence of this understanding is presented in the Purusha Sukta. How the first sacrifice was performed by the demigods, who themselves came out of his limbs, and they created the universe by performing sacrifice with ingredients coming from his body. Okay. Now the Vedic path is a gradual path. There's karmakanda, jnanakanda, upasanakanda. That means persons who are very materialistic, they can still be purified by performing sacrifice. You may have desires to enjoy this world, to control and enjoy, but if you accept the Vedic authority and you follow the rules and perform sacrifice, you will be purified and elevated to a higher level. That's called karma. Karmis are those who perform sacrifice. Klaubad very kindly used it in a euphemistic way. He called people, everybody on the street, karmis. Now, the non-devotees are karmis, but that's actually a very polite thing to say. To call someone a karmi is a great compliment, because it means a performance of Vedic sacrifice. So the beginning of that ladder of progress is the performance of karma. Those who accept the authority of the Vedas, accept the authority of the demigods, accept the authority of the Brahmins, and engage either directly or indirectly in the performance of sacrifice, they're called karmis. And if someone becomes purified by karma, he can be introduced into how to meditate on the universal form. Even materialists who can't see, can't understand that anything exists beyond the material world, they can meditate on the different aspects of creation as the body of God. They can't understand or believe that God has a spiritual body. Okay, meditate on the universal form. So those who make progress as karmis, they can graduate to this virat rup, or universal form meditation. And then those who become more purified by meditating on the universal form, they can be introduced to meditating on the supersoul, on the transcendental body of the supersoul in the heart. And then those who graduate from that, from the meditation on the supersoul, they can be introduced to meditation on the Supreme Personality of Godhead's different lila avatars. So that's the Vedic ladder. That's actually taught in the Vedas. That's the Vedic course of instruction. That's what the real message of the Vedas are. And that's being explained in these first chapters by Shukadeva Goswami. This gradual ladder of progress leading up to pure devotional service. Of course, Krishna is going to, throughout the Bhagavatam, describe the avatars, and then when he gets to the 10th canto, he'll describe the pastimes of the original personality of Godhead Krishna.
Is that further in the sage?
Yes?
Is that appropriate in the
sage? No, it's not appropriate for us to try to do that. But it is appropriate for us to read the Bhagavatam and know about it theoretically. That this ladder of gradual progress is there. We should be aware of it as much as it's explained to us in the Bhagavatam. So we should study deeply these chapters, not that we should sit down and try to perform this same meditation, but we should be familiar with it, as much information as Sri Gita Goswami gives us. All we need to know is right here. You want to become an expert yogi? Just study these three chapters. Everything about yoga is here. Not the details. But since we're not going to practice it ourselves, we don't need the details. But the essence is all here. Did everybody take one of these? Okay. And then tomorrow we'll hand out the other two chapters, but the assignment for today is to read one chapter. Okay. Now I want to talk a little bit about Shukadeva Goswami. Who he is, what his background is, and what is he trying to do here? What's his purpose in talking with Kriksha Maharaj? He didn't have to come to Hastinapur. He was wandering around trying to avoid all contact with human society. He had no social connection at all. He didn't even take initiation from his father. He didn't even bother to take initiation. Only one thing he did in this world was listen to the Bhagavatam. And beside that, he was just wandering around. Everyone thought he was crazy. Women and children were following him, taunting him. But he came. He arrived on the scene just to speak to Pariksit Maharaj. Why? What was his purpose? Why did he do this? Why did he bother to come and speak? Why did he bother to listen to the Bhagavatam, and why did he bother to speak it to Pariksit? So we know that Sukadeva was a Brahmavadi, impersonalist, seeker of the absolute truth in its impersonal form. We call him a Brahmavadi, not a Mayavadi. The Mayavadis are envious of God. They can know about Krishna, but they hate him. And they want to destroy him, in effect, by obliterating his personality. The Brahmavadis are something else. They're sincere seekers of the absolute truth, but for one reason or another, they can't really understand his personality. We have different tendencies. Some of us are materialistic. We like to enjoy, in various ways. And other people, they're attracted to impersonalism. It's another material tendency. And it's hard for impersonalists to accept that the absolute truth is ultimately a person. Personality is there, but the impersonalist thinks that all personality is illusion. That the absolute truth can't have any personality, can't have any form, any differentiation. Ekam Advatiyam Brahma. The absolute truth is one without a second. No division, no form, no name, no nothing. And when we have a conception of God as a person, that's some convenient illusion for innocent people to meditate on to help them become gradually advanced. And then when they become advanced, they can throw away this conception of a personality of God and graduate to the true understanding of the impersonal truth. And there's so many Mayavadis. You go out and find one on the street very easily. I mean, it's all over the place. Very intelligent people, very sincere people, who are convinced that the absolute truth is ultimately not a person. The world is full, especially India, is full of them. And Shukadeva Goswami was one of these, a sincere Brahmavadi, but he was convinced that the absolute truth is ultimately impersonal. And he was very advanced and very detached from material life. He was, he entered the womb of Vyasadeva's wife, Satyavati. He's the son of Vyasadeva. But he was so detached and so uninterested in Maya, so afraid of Maya, that he refused to come out of the womb. For 16 years, Shukadeva Goswami didn't come out of his mother's womb. So the description of the 12th canto, how his mother got quite worried after having this child in her womb for 16 years. And she finally asked Vyasadeva, You have to go to Dwarka, speak to Krishna, ask him to come here. Nobody else is going to get this boy out. So you go ask Krishna to come here. So Vyasadeva left Padarik Ashram and went all the way to Dwarka, which is some 1,800 kilometers or something, by foot. And he asked Krishna to come, and Krishna came by chariot and brought Vyasadeva back. And so Krishna came to the ashram, the cave in which Vyasadeva lived on the bank of the Saraswati, and personally asked Shukadeva, you come out, please, out of your mother's womb. I promise you Maya will never touch you, but on my request, please come out. This is described in Brahma Vaivarta Purana, and there's also some mention of it in the 12th canto. Shukadeva Goswami agreed, he took birth, but he wouldn't stay home for 1 minute. He immediately walked away and would not even accept anything, any service of it, and wouldn't stay home, even as an infant. But he was already 16 years old. Now, Vyasadeva is described at the beginning of the Bhagavatam. Tat putreti tanmayataya taravo binedus. Vyasadeva is following his son, crying out, oh my son, please come back. And no response from Shukadev. Instead, only the trees echoed his anguish, anguished cries. Then Vyasadev decided, okay, there's only one thing that's going to attract this boy to come back. And he told some of his disciples, you go ahead on the road, run ahead, and you stand in the bushes there. And as he passes by, you recite some shlokas from the Bhagavatam. And this is described in Brahma Vaivarta Purana. Shukadeva Goswami heard these verses recited by Vyasadeva's disciples, and his mind was changed. He was attracted. And then he came home, and he studied the Bhagavatam from his father. So he wasn't a personalist, but hearing the Bhagavatam spoken by Vyasadeva through his disciples attracted his heart and changed his heart and attracted him to Krishna's devotees and to Krishna's pure devotional service. So he very quickly became one of the best of the pure devotees of Krishna, very dear to the Vaishnavas, Vishnu Jana Priyaha, became a changed man overnight. At the same time, it's a common thing that even when someone becomes sadhana siddha, perfect by devotional practice, he's not conditioned anymore, but he uses his past conditioning, his past prarabdha karma, in Krishna's service in some way. Just like Sanatana Goswami was, he was a Nitya Siddha devotee, but he was also a very competent diplomat and administrator, practical man. So he used that. Even when he was ready to give everything up, he was stuck in jail, so he knew how to bribe the jailkeeper to get himself out. He knew how to do what was necessary, practical. Like that, Shukadeva Goswami had his past conditioning. He was a Brahmavadi, a philosopher, a seeker of the absolute truth, a meditator. He used those skills and those propensities to good advantage in his presentation of Srimad Bhagavatam. The style of his presentation and some of the content is echoes the kind of person he used to be, using his past conditioning in Krishna's service. Although he's no longer conditioned, he still has those abilities, and he's using them for the advancement of Krishna consciousness. So he focused on the kind of topic, especially here in the beginning of the second canto. He's talking about things that impersonalists like to talk about. Universal form, meditation on Omkar, meditation on the super soul. These are typical Brahmavadi or typical impersonalist topics. And Shukadeva is, one way to look at it is he's using his past abilities to good use. We'll stop here just with, I want to mention what's his purpose. Basically three things that Shukadeva Goswami was trying to accomplish. He wanted to establish the superiority of pure devotional service. That's the first thing he's trying to do in the beginning of his discussion here. This is stated by Vishwanath Chakravarti in the beginning of his commentary. Adhyayais tribir utkarsho bhaktir. In the first three chapters, according to Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, in the first three chapters, Shukadeva Goswami establishes the supremacy of pure devotional service over all other spiritual practices. So Shukadeva does it by comparison. He explains these other practices and gradually shows step by step how one's better than the other and how pure devotional service is the best. In these three chapters. Okay. The second thing he's trying to accomplish in the beginning of his teachings to Parikshit is what's the gradual process of advancement for those who can't immediately take to pure devotional service? For those who aren't ready, how can they gradually become ready? Like Krishna says in the 11th canto to Uddhava, Tavat karmani kurvati kurvita na nirvijyate karhichit na yat matkata shravanado va yava shradhana jayate. One should continue doing karma, doing ritualistic duties, sacrifices, only until he develops attraction, or until he becomes disinterested, gives up his interest in them, and becomes attracted to hearing topics about me, Krishna is saying to Uddhava. Until someone becomes disgusted with fruitive work, and especially until he becomes attracted to Krishna Katha, he should continue doing his karma. Or his yoga, or whatever. Whatever level he's on, karmi, gyani. But only when you get real attraction to hearing and chanting, then you're ready for pure devotional service. So the gradual process has to be presented for those who aren't ready for pure devotional service. That Shukadeva Goswami treats in these first few chapters, and then the rest of the Bhagavatam after that, after these three or four chapters, is all about pure devotional service. And the last thing that Shukadeva is trying to accomplish in these first chapters is he's trying to test his disciple, Pariksit Maharaj. Test him in the sense, do you really want to hear about Krishna's pure devotional service, or can I offer you something less? Why waste my time discussing such an elevated topic if you're not really serious about it? Would you be satisfied with some explanation how to chant Omkar? Or maybe meditate on the Super Soul? That'll give you liberation. Is that all you want? So he's testing him. He's not going to bother to explain the essence of pure devotional service unless he's convinced that Shukadev doesn't want anything else. That Parikshit doesn't want anything else. So these first chapters are also a test of the disciple. Is he ready? Is he eager for pure devotional service and nothing else? Okay, I've gone about 10 minutes too late. Maybe we'll stop the class, and then if anybody wants to ask questions, we can talk informally. I don't want to leave anybody hungry. It's lunchtime. Okay? If anybody wants to sit here, we'll discuss a few questions, but the class is finished. You can please go. Yes. Well, that's just the mystery of the whole thing is that the book's eternal, but you have historical events being narrated in them. So what happens is that people come periodically in history. There's a Shukadeva Goswami appears, and maybe in a different age another he appears again, and he acts out the script. The script is already written. They just speak the words and act out the descriptions. They follow the script. But it's not like just doing, thank you. It's not like just actors on the stage. In a sense, the devotees who are... Okay, we'll go out to the hallway. Yeah, okay. Okay. We gotta evacuate.